most busted in Laredo, but for reasons that I'd rather not disclose.
I smoke pot, and I like it a lot. Hi, this is Willie Nelson. I learned a long time ago that marijuana is a lot safer to use than alcohol. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the responsible use of marijuana by adults. It's time we stopped arresting and started respecting responsible marijuana smokers in America. And to learn what you can do to help, please contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORMAL.
The show was long and we were just sitting there, and we'd come to play and not just for the ride.
Distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to the Audio Stash today. It is Thursday, August 2nd. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to help end senseless marijuana prohibition in America. Make sure to make your donation or join right now at norml.org. Tomorrow on the program, we'll speak with former Dallas Cowboy and now Normal Advisory Board member Mark Stepnoski about the event he's emceeing down in Austin, Texas, the Austin Freedom Fest. Willie Nelson will be on stage, along with Megan Tubb, Carolyn Wonderland, Ray Benson, and Asleep at the Wheel, among others. You can get your tickets now, and make sure to do it because these tickets are flying out the door. Visit AustinFreedomFest.org. We have links at NormalAudioStash.com to get your tickets today. Here in the Audio Stash today, we're going to explore an unfortunate anniversary. The federal prohibition of marijuana was signed into law 70 years ago today, and it stands as one of our government's greatest public policy failures. On August 2, 1937, then-President Franklin Roosevelt signed the Marijuana Tax Act into law, which criminalized the possession and use of cannabis through prohibitive taxation. In 1969, the Supreme Court struck down the 1937 law. However, in 1970, Congress included cannabis as a Schedule I substance under the U.S. Controlled Substances Act. The Presidential Commission on Marijuana, known as the Schaefer Commission, determined in 1972 that marijuana should be removed from Schedule I, but then-President Nixon chose to ignore that recommendation. We'll be exploring this 70th anniversary of federal cannabis prohibition today with information from Normal senior policy analyst Paul Armentano and guests such as Dale Gerringer of California Normal, Keith Strupp, the founder of Normal, Richard Bonney, who sat on the 1972 Schaefer Commission, and Dr. Lester Grinspoon. Let's begin with a historical overview. We have links to a full document from Normal that contains the following information on our website at normalaudiostash.com. Marijuana cultivation in the United States can trace its lineage some 400 years. For most of our nation's history, farmers grew marijuana, then known exclusively as hemp, for fiber content. Colonialists planted the first American hemp crop in 1611 near Jamestown, Virginia. Soon after, King James I of Britain ordered settlers to engage in wide-scale farming of the plant. Most of the sails and ropes on colonial ships were made from hemp, as were many of the colonists' Bibles, clothing, and maps. According to some historians, George Washington and Thomas Jefferson cultivated marijuana and advocated a hemp-based economy. Some colonies even made hemp cultivation compulsory and called its production necessary for the, quote, wealth and protection of the country, close quote. Marijuana cultivation continued as an agricultural staple in America through the turn of the 20th century. Marijuana first earned recognition as an intoxicant in the 1920s and 30s. Recreational use of the drug became associated primarily with Mexican-American immigrant workers and the African-American jazz musician community of the time. It was during this time that hemp was renamed marijuana, and the plant's long-standing history as a cash crop was replaced with a new image, the devil's weed.
Racing through the void, nothing but stars and sand. I ride the list of God, baby, through the desert lands. Through the dust and smoke, only friction prevails.
In 1930, the federal government founded the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, or FBN, headed by Commissioner Harry Anslinger. The group launched a misinformation propaganda campaign against the drug and enrolled the services of Hollywood and several tabloid newspapers. Headlines across the nation began publicizing alleged reports of insanity and violence induced by, quote, reefer smoking, close quote. Very exaggerated accounts of violent crimes committed by immigrants reportedly intoxicated by marijuana became popularized. Once under the influence of the drug, criminals purportedly knew no fear and lost all inhibition. For example, a news bulletin issued by the FBN in the early 1930s reported that a marijuana user, quote, becomes a fiend with savage or caveman tendencies. His sex desires are aroused, and some of the most horrible crimes result. He hears light and sees sound. To get away from it, he suddenly becomes violent and may kill, close quote. Similar reports swept across the country. A widely publicized issue of the Journal of Criminal Law and Criminology asserted that the marijuana user is capable of, quote, great feats of strength and endurance, during which no fatigue is felt. Sexual desires are stimulated and may lead to unnatural acts, such as exposure and rape. Use of marijuana ends in the destruction of brain tissues, nerve centers, and does irreparable damage. If continued, the inevitable result is insanity, which those familiar with it described as absolutely incurable and without exception, ending in death. Close quote. A Washington Times editorial published shortly before Congress held its first hearings on the issue argued, quote, the fatal marijuana cigarette must be recognized as a deadly drug, and American children must be protected against it, close quote. This steady stream of propaganda influenced 27 states to pass laws against marijuana in the years leading up to the federal prohibition, and set the stage, both culturally and politically, for the passage of the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937. Representative Robert L. Daunton of North Carolina introduced the act to Congress on April 14, 1937, to criminalize the recreational use of marijuana through prohibitive taxation. The bill was the brainchild of Commissioner Anslinger, who later testified before Congress in support of the bill. Congress held only two hearings to debate the merits of marijuana prohibition. The hearings totaled just 1 hour. Federal witness Harry Anslinger testified before the House Ways and Means Committee that, quote, this drug is entirely the monster hide, the harmful effect of which cannot be measured, close quote. He was joined by Assistant General Counsel for the Department of the Treasury, Clinton Hester, who affirmed the drug's eventual effect on the user, quote, is deadly, close quote. These statements summarized the federal government's official position and served as the initial justification for criminalizing marijuana smoking. The American Medical Association, or AMA, represented the lone voice against marijuana prohibition before Congress. AMA Legislative Counsel Dr. William C. Woodward testified, quote, there is no evidence, close quote, that marijuana is a dangerous drug. Woodward challenged the propriety of passing legislation based only on newspaper accounts and questioned why no data from the Bureau of Prisons or the Children's Bureau supported the FBN's position. He further argued that the legislation would severely compromise a physician's ability to utilize marijuana's therapeutic potential. Surprisingly, the committee took little interest in Woodward's testimony and told the physician, quote, if you want to advise us on legislation, you ought to have come here with some constructive proposals, rather than trying to throw obstacles in the way of something that the federal government is trying to do, close quote. After just one hearing, the Ways and Means Committee approved the Marijuana Tax Act. The House of Representatives followed suit on August 20th after engaging in only 90 seconds of debate. During this abbreviated floor discussion, only two questions were asked. First, a member of Congress from upstate New York asked Speaker Sam Rayburn to summarize the purpose of the bill. Rayburn replied, quote, I don't know. It has something to do with a thing called marijuana. I think it's a narcotic of some kind, close quote. The same representative then asked, quote, Mr. Speaker, does the American Medical Association support the bill, close quote. Falsely, a member of the Ways and Means Committee replied, quote, their doctor gave this measure his full support, as well as the approval of the American Medical Association, close quote. Following this brief exchange of inaccurate information, the House approved the federal prohibition of marijuana without a recorded vote. Daughton's bill sailed through the Senate with the same ease. The Senate held one brief hearing on the bill before overwhelmingly approving the measure. President Franklin Roosevelt promptly signed the legislation into law on August 2, 1937. The Marijuana Tax Act took effect October 1, 1937. Thus began the criminal prohibition of marijuana that remains in place today. Growing and selling marijuana were still legal at the time, but only if you bought a $1 government stamp, and that stamp was not for sale. On the very day the Marijuana Tax Stamp Act was enacted, October 2, 1937, the FBI and Denver, Colorado police raided the Lexington Hotel and arrested Samuel R. Caldwell, 58 years old, an unemployed laborer, and Moses Baca, 26 years old. On October 5th, Caldwell went into history and trivia books as the first marijuana seller convicted under U.S. federal law. His customer, Baca, was found guilty of possession. Caldwell's wares, two marijuana cigarettes, deeply offended Judge Foster Sims, who said, quote, I consider marijuana the worst of all narcotics, far worse than the use of morphine or cocaine. Under its influence, men become beasts. Marijuana destroys life itself. I have no sympathy with those who sell this weed. The government is going to enforce this new law to the letter. Close quote. Caldwell was sentenced to 4 years of hard labor in Leavenworth Penitentiary, plus a $1,000 fine. Baca received 18 months incarceration. Both men served every day of their sentence. A year after Caldwell was released from prison, he died. Today, almost 800,000 Americans are arrested each year for marijuana prohibition violations. 90% of these arrests are made for simple marijuana possession.
Understand, you cannot cage people like animals and not expect them to fight back someday.
Dale Gerringer is the coordinator of California Normal in San Francisco. You can see Dale tonight with Glenn Beck on CNN. I asked Dale to tell us a bit more about the act and its impact.
It was sort of, it was supported by some sensationalist Reefer Madness stories in the press, the Hearst Press in particular. Testifying against that bill, let it be remembered, was the American Medical Association, which pointed out that marijuana had been a useful and not dangerous drug, cannabis, been used for over a century in the United States, and objected that the bill would interfere with and eliminate its availability to medicine, which proved to be the case, and it was about 3 years later that the last medicinal cannabis was available in drugstores in the United States because the Tax Act made it really impossible and uneconomical to sell it in drugstores as well. The hemp industry also took a hit, and they weren't happy about the bill, but nobody cared about them. So it was really, the law was engineered by the drug enforcement establishment, and that's been true of the cannabis laws everywhere. This was not the first anti-marijuana law in the United States. Many states passed anti-marijuana laws much earlier. California, where I'm from, had one of the earliest ones in 1913. That was also done by our State Board of Pharmacy, which was trying to expand its authority by going after not only opiates and cocaine, but they threw in cannabis because it was being used by East Indian Hindu immigrants, supposedly, at the time. So, you know, marijuana has not been legal in California since 1913. Of course, the irony of it is when marijuana was made illegal, even in 1937, for that matter, in the United States, very few people were using it. The idea of the law was to prevent it from being used. It's only since marijuana became illegal that it's become this great big problem with millions of people using it and usage spreading much farther than anyone had ever imagined before. So the law itself has been a complete failure on its own terms, and all of the difficulties, all of the problems that can be ascribed, that our opponents have ascribed to marijuana, can at least not be blamed on us having a legal marijuana market. It's happened under their auspices in an illegal marijuana market. So I think that deserves to be remembered here.
Dale, we see a racial disparity in prohibition enforcement today. New York City, which arrests more people for marijuana prohibition violations than any other U.S. city, has 85% of their marijuana arrestees being black or Hispanic. But in 1937, prohibition was also a part of institutional racism as well.
Well, marijuana was used most especially by, I guess, in the Mexican community. Marijuana is a Mexican word. Until the word was brought from Mexico, it was always referred to as cannabis or Indian hemp originally. Also, let's not overlook jazz musicians, primarily African American. Marijuana became pretty popular amongst them in the 1920s, and that was part of the anti-marijuana campaign. Harry Anslinger, who was head of Federal Bureau of Narcotics, was also very much an opponent of jazz. He thought the music didn't make much sense. The musicians weren't following the tune and the rhythm properly, and this was because of the influence of marijuana. And tried subsequently to arrest a bunch of leading jazz musicians on marijuana charges, but fortunately President Truman stopped it.
It seems like a lot of the false propaganda used in 1937 remains in place today by the DEA and the ONDCP. Now, has the prohibitionist agenda and the politics of prohibitionists even evolved in the last 70 years?
I don't think so at all. It's gotten more the penalties have gotten worse. They've up, you know, they continue upgrading the penalties, and then they take away your driver's license and your eligibility for student loans and welfare benefit, all this other stuff that they've been doing. But the basic theory has been there all along, and I think people have to recognize for what it was. It was a project by law enforcement to create more jobs for narcotics agents. Narcotics enforcement establishment wrote these laws and has always been in the forefront of pushing for tougher laws because it's jobs for them.
Now, Dale, we know that 97 million Americans have smoked marijuana. The federal government admits that even today, 6,000 people try cannabis for the first time every single day. But do you think most folks have forgotten how all this began?
People take it for granted that drugs are illegal these days. You know, I mean, any drug is illegal unless you get it, on a doctor's prescription. That wasn't the case before the 1940s. And as I always say, in my grandparents' day, which is looking back at the turn of the last century, it was perfectly legal for Americans to buy any drug at the drugstore. You could buy morphine and cocaine and heroin over the counter. Any drug could be bought over the counter. There were no laws against it, and drug abuse was a lesser problem then than it came to be afterwards when the black market got created by the drug laws. But people now sort of take it for granted that drugs are somehow an illegal activity, although that was never the assumption in the 19th century. It's sort of funny. I think drugs and sex have sort of traded places in over this century. At the beginning of the last century, there were all sorts of laws about what kinds of sexual acts people couldn't do, and, you know, practically everything outside of married sex without birth control was illegal in the United States. Those laws were discarded during the 60s and 70s, and now they're poo-pooed, and everybody, in almost every state now, adultery is legal. But we've traded our ancestors' hang-up over sex for a hang-up over drugs, which our ancestors never had. So now, people are all concerned about doing legal and politically correct drugs, but they don't have to worry about sex anymore. But when you think about it, I wonder, is more human damage done by unsafe drugs or by unsafe sexual practices? It's a pretty close call in my opinion, but somehow we take it for granted that people have a right to, these days, to their bodily privacy when it comes to sex, but not when it comes to drugs.
That was Dale Gerringer of California Normal. You can see Dale tonight with Glenn Beck on CNN. Next up today, we spoke with Richard Bonney, who teaches law at the University of Virginia. Mr. Bonney has authored and co-authored many legal textbooks. He's also co-author of The Marijuana Conviction, A History of Marijuana Prohibition in the United States. Mr. Bonney sat on the 1972 Schaefer Commission that recommended marijuana be removed from Schedule 1 in the Controlled Substances Act. He joined us by phone from his office at the University of Virginia today.
I think the Marijuana Tax Act has obviously played an important historical role in the story about marijuana prohibition that we're still grappling with now. Let me say a couple of words about it. One is I think people might have a little bit of a misconception historically about it, because they may be surprised to learn that just about every state had already prohibited marijuana at the state level even before the Marijuana Tax Act was passed. And what the Marijuana Tax Act did was just put a layer of federal prohibition, in effect functionally prohibition, over top of the state law. But aside from that, the historical importance of the Marijuana Tax Act is really the somewhat comical nature of the hearings by which it was passed. There was very, very little substantive discussion about marijuana and whether a federal prohibition was really needed. There were extremely exaggerated accounts that were of the dangers of marijuana and that it caused crime, insanity, and addiction. that had become fairly widespread in some of the propaganda of the day, and they were basically just transmitted to Congress in a very short period of hearings. And pretty much the only objection that was raised to the passage of the Marijuana Tax Act was by the representative from the American Medical Association, who wondered why it was necessary to pass this legislation. There really had been no demonstrated national problem, and also was concerned about the way in which the act might actually limit even legitimate medical uses of marijuana at the time.
Has there been a significant shift on this issue in the last 70 years that could indeed change this policy, do you think?
A lot of things have changed. For one thing, there was not a lot of systematic scientific knowledge about marijuana and its effects at the time, and so the way was basically left open for the fairly widespread exaggerations and propaganda and all the myths about marijuana, and there was really no voice out there to kind of stand up against this propaganda. And I think the situation in that respect is considerably different now. Today we don't have a consensus about marijuana legislation, and I think there was a consensus at the time because there really wasn't that much of a dissenting voice. And as I said, I think the situation is very different now. Another important historical note, I suppose, about the Marijuana Tax Act is that it was, as you pointed out at the beginning, a tax act. And people today might sort of wonder why it took that particular shape. And the answer to that is that the first federal narcotics or drug, what we would say today is drug legislation or controlled substances legislation, the Harrison Narcotics Act, was passed in 1914. And it was also a tax measure, which many of those drugs, of course, were used in medicine, and so there were legitimate channels of distribution for them. But what Congress really wanted to do was to suppress all non-medical use of the drug, and so it essentially imposed a requirement that anybody that wanted to distribute the drug register, and then if for failure to register, there was a prohibitive tax that was imposed, which essentially made it into a criminal law. And the reason that it took that form was because the constitutional rulings of the Supreme Court at that time raised serious questions about whether the federal government had the authority to directly regulate the use and distribution and production of at that time the opiates and cocaine, which were essentially local activities. The Congress could prohibit the shipment in interstate commerce. But to get really at the regulation of the use and distribution and prescription of those drugs, it was essentially regarded as a local function and too much of an intrusion, for example, into medical practice. So in order to avoid the constitutional limits on the power to regulate interstate commerce, which prohibited regulating local activities, Congress used this tax device and used its taxation powers. Well, then when the decision was made to seek federal legislation to deal with marijuana, the same structure, a tax structure, was used in order to avoid these constitutional problems. It might also be noted that the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, which is basically the major propagandist in this story, resisted actually adopting federal legislation for many years because it did not want to endanger the constitutional status of the Harrison Act. But eventually they decided to go ahead and go forward with the Marijuana Tax Act. That whole structure, which is basically historically rooted, has now been swept away because the Congress has regulated all controlled substances, including marijuana, under the Controlled Substances Act of 1970, directly under the federal power to regulate interstate commerce, and the Supreme Court has upheld it.
And Professor Bonney, the Controlled Substances Act brought us into this modern era of cannabis prohibition. Is that structure perhaps more difficult to roll back than the Tax Stamp Act would have been if that law were still in place?
No, I don't think so. I would basically, what I would say is that we are really dealing with quite the reverse of the problem from a drug policy standpoint that existed in 1937. You know, as I've said, there was really pretty much of a consensus about the desirability of prohibiting marijuana, even though that consensus was rooted, you know, in many respects on a lot of mythical understandings of the nature of the use of the dangers of marijuana. But it was, you know, widely accepted in, you know, across the country. And then, as I said, the Marijuana Tax Act really just sort of blanketed the country with what is in effect a federal prohibition on top of all these state prohibitions. Now what we have is a situation where there's a lot of dissension about the prohibition of marijuana, and particularly it's the limitations, the current limitations on the use, compassionate medical uses, as well as, of course, you know, issues relating to the non-medical use and the possibility of decriminalizing possession and so on. I mean, so there's a lot of dispute now about marijuana, and of course many of the states basically do not agree with the federal policy and would like to have, you know, have some leeway to depart from it. So what with the situation that we're in now is in terms of the federal law is convincing the Congress to loosen up the federal prohibition in order to provide some leeway for the states to experiment with different approaches, including a little bit of an opportunity to provide regulated opportunities for medical use. And in order to do that, you basically have to convince Congress to loosen federal regulation.
Professor, more than a few congressmen have appeared right here on the program and called the current issue of the DEA raiding medical marijuana dispensaries in places like California a states' rights battle with the government. Is that legally a reality, or is it really a simple states' rights issue, or does this federal prohibition need to change so that the states' medical marijuana laws already in place can operate unimpeded by federal authorities?
Well, clearly the states, I mean, the Supreme Court has made it clear, the states do not have the authority to displace the federal prohibition. I mean, the states can loosen up their laws all they want, but it's still going to be a federal offense to cultivate, possess, distribute marijuana in violation of federal law. The states simply cannot do anything about that because the federal law, under current constitutional rulings, even by the current states' rights-oriented Supreme Court, is the current statute is constitutional. So what has to be done is that, you know, either the federal law needs basically to not be enforced, you know, by the federal government, so that by exercising some enforcement discretion, federal policymakers could leave the states free to, you know, experiment in the way that some of them are doing. Obviously, that's not the position of the current administration. The other possibility is basically to convince the Congress to basically reclassify marijuana, for example. I mean, this is one strategy that can be used to reclassify marijuana from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2, and then say that, you know, in a specific provision that the states would, it would not be a violation of the federal law for people to use or distribute marijuana in accord with state law, medical use laws that conformed to certain conditions that might be set out in the federal legislation. I mean, I think that would be the best approach to take at this time to loosen up federal law, is to basically try to convince Congress that this is an important states' rights issue and that a properly designed state law would not pose a threat to the overall currently existing drug policies as they relate to non-medical use. Now, non-medical use is obviously another controversial issue, but if we're talking specifically about medical uses, it seems to me that Congress, that it would be sensible for Congress to give the states a little bit more leeway than they now have. And frankly, that's the only way that we're going to be able to get this changed.
That was Professor Richard Bonney. He teaches law at the University of Virginia. He co-authored The Marijuana Conviction, A History of Marijuana Prohibition in the United States, and sat on the 1972 Schaefer Commission. We have links for more information about Professor Richard Bonney on our website at normalaudiostash.com.
You're listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
Joining us next today is Keith Strupp, the founder of Normal and the current legal counsel. I asked Keith how the 1937 Tax Stamp Act was different from the way alcohol was prohibited in the 1920s.
Remember that with alcohol prohibition, the country at that point, our constitutional law was such as people accepted the fact that we needed a constitutional amendment if we were going to prohibit alcohol. And it took a second constitutional amendment to repeal alcohol prohibition. Unfortunately, by 1937, when the Federal Act came along, they had reinterpreted federal powers, given them much broader authority, and were allowed to prohibit marijuana without a constitutional amendment, with a simple act of Congress. But again, I think those are interesting footnotes for those of us who study the issue and care about it, and on days like this when we're celebrating a bit of an anniversary. But I think the real impact doesn't matter much. If it's illegal under state and federal law, you're going to have a lot of otherwise law-abiding citizens who have their lives destroyed needlessly.
Keith, we just heard from law professor Richard Bonney that we really need to change these federal laws, even for states that have enacted medical marijuana, to have their programs completely unimpeded.
Well, I think there's no question about it. First off, I don't know of anyone in the drug law reform movement who is proposing that Congress should dictate marijuana policy for the country. In fact, for most of us, that's the opposite of what we would like to see. What we really want is for Congress to simply get out of the way so that the various 50 state legislatures can experiment when they're ready with different models of regulation and taxation and age controls. When our forefathers set this federal system up, they specifically talked about the state legislatures as being state laboratories. The intention was that you could experiment with various models of policy models at the state level. If something went wrong, it's not such a big mistake. It can easily be corrected the next legislative session, and it only applies to one state anyway. Unfortunately, once the federal government got involved, they sort of took over the field, and the states no longer, until we change federal law, the states no longer have the option of experimenting with regulatory models. They can remove their own criminal penalties for possession and use and even sale if they wanted to, but they cannot legally right now establish any sort of a regulatory system, because that would put them in direct conflict with federal law and the Supremacy Clause would kick in. So it's terribly important that we get Congress to back out of federal prohibition and allow the various states to do what they want. Some states will continue prohibition for a number of years, I'm quite certain, but there would be other states within 2 or 3 or 4 years that I think would adopt a regulatory system that taxed marijuana and had age controls.
On the other side of things here, Keith, if this 1937 Tax Act were actually followed and tax stamps actually printed, issued, and made available for purchase, if the act had taken on a different political spirit at some point, marijuana would be a regulated substance today as opposed to a prohibited one.
Oh, of course. In some ways, it would have been a regulatory system. You would have had to pay a federal tax in order to get your marijuana. However, keep in mind that when it was put in place, it was not intended as a revenue measure. They intentionally set the tax at such a high level, I forget precisely what it was, but compared to, you know, this is back in 1937, it was essentially a prohibitory tax. No one could afford to pay the tax that was set up, so therefore no one could have marijuana legally, even back in 1937. But if the federal government, or if the federal government would back out and allow some of the states to adopt an honest tax system, where, for example, maybe for an ounce of marijuana you paid the state a couple hundred dollars in taxes, I wouldn't have any problem with that at all. That would be the beginning of experimenting with a regulatory model. It might not be the perfect model, but it would certainly be a lot better than the one we have today.
That was Keith Strupp, the founder of Normal. And finally today, we got the chance to speak with Dr. Lester Grinspoon. He's professor emeritus of psychiatry at Harvard University and author of the landmark book Marijuana Reconsidered. He currently maintains the website, marijuanausus.com. I asked Dr. Grinspoon today about the role of the American Medical Association in those 1937 congressional hearings and its relationship with marijuana since.
Marijuana, by 1937, wasn't being used much as a medicine for two reasons. Two reasons being that in the 19th century, two of its most common applications were as an analgesic, a pain reliever, and a soporific, something to make people help people get to sleep. At the turn of the century, well, respectively 1898 and 1900, acetylsalicylic acid was synthesized, that is aspirin, and then the first of the phenobarbitals was synthesized, so that physicians now had a nice, clean way of prescribing a pain pill, aspirin, or a soporific, a sleeping pill, namely a barbiturate. And this they preferred because when you prescribed cannabis indica was used quite a bit at that time, but when you prescribed cannabis indica, it was a solution of an extract of cannabis with alcohol as the diluent. And the problem was physicians didn't know, they couldn't adjust the dose very well. They'd tell somebody to take so many minims per day or per what period of time. And it was only an hour and a half or 2 hours later when the patient realized he landed right on the money and got good relief, or he didn't get enough of it and got very little relief or got too much of it, and especially as the oral form had some anxiety. Now, physicians persisted with this because despite these difficulties, it was not a dangerous drug. It was not a toxic drug. They didn't have to worry about that. But when it was possible to prescribe precise dosage with aspirin or barbiturate for these two purposes, which were the primary thing that was being prescribed for at that time, they moved over to those two drugs. And then cannabis fell out of the pharmacopoeia in 1941, about 4 years after the Marijuana Tax Act, which was, as you say, passed on August 2nd, 1937. The AMA, when played a part, a significant role in the Marijuana Tax Act hearings before Mr. Dingell, who was the chair, Dr. W.C. Woodward, who was legislative counsel for the American Medical Association, I believe he was not he was a physician and a lawyer, was in fact the only witness that offered any resistance to the act. There were a few other people who were worried about what the effect of the act would have on oil seed and on bird seed were the two main commercial interests represented at those hearings, and in fact the committee did make some arrangements for birds but not for people. So the Marijuana Tax Act was passed, and as you know what the penalties were, and the AMA then sort of went to sleep on it. It wasn't a great loss to physicians because of the growing body of synthetic drugs which were much more attractive to physicians before they became substances which physicians became more sensitive to with regard to side effects, a euphemism for toxic effects. But the AMA did have a lapse in its opposition to this in 1942. A paper was published in the American Journal of Psychiatry on cannabis. It came out of the two psychiatrists who were part of the LaGuardia Commission, the people who were studying it. And the Journal of the AMA found that that was a sound study and should be supported, very laudatory. But then in 1944, when this fellow Rupp, who was the representative from the World Health Association, objected to, wrote a letter objecting and belittling the Mayer's report, the LaGuardia report, and just subsequent to that, the AMA came out with a really damning editorial on marijuana. It abandoned its customary editorial restraint and voiced its wrath in scolding terms. And that was, and from then on, the AMA was silent on marijuana until 1965, June in 1965, when they published Marijuana as a Medicine, A Plea for Reconsideration, which I and James Bacaloff wrote. And in fact, the then editor of the AMA subsequently got fired, as you know. And this was one of the things that they held against him. So the AMA has had a checkered career on this ever since it fell out of the Pharmacopeia, or even before that, when Woodward very courageously tried to stand up to the Dingell Committee.
That was Dr. Lester Grinspoon, Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry at Harvard University and author of the book Marijuana Reconsidered. You can visit his website at marijuana-usis.com. We have links to it at normalaudiostash.com.
Selector, run the beat.
Life is a struggle.
Check, check my rules. Yeah. Is a struggle.
1, 2,
come on. Check. Check. Da, run the beat.
Life is a struggle.
Boy,
yeah.
Check. Check. Boy, yeah. Is a struggle. 1, 2, come on. Right away.
The crowd screaming, they announce numero uno Don Chameleon, three-time champion, the only player playing every position. Roll it, light it, pass it, did I mention? My salary makes a lot of motherfuckers mad at me. My strategy, making sure you can't harass me. I'm telling you, G, you better off riding the bench. What I do to my opponents, it don't make sense. She on the defense for 90 fucking minutes. Meanwhile, my style is officially wild. You need to realize, we see the real lies. That's why they never want to read legal lies.
Take me.
Really?
it back as system attacks are right to light it up. We can fight with music, cause we know the right way to use it. We're winners, one way or another, getting it up with our Germany brothers. It's the same shit going on all over the world. Legalize it, don't suppress the herd. Really, really.
Chris Goldstein, thanks for listening to our special program here today on the history of the 1937 Marijuana Tax Stamp Act. Make sure that marijuana prohibition doesn't last another year. Take action right now. Contact your local legislators. Contact your congresspeople. Contact your senators. If you have a chance during this presidential political season, ask the marijuana questions that need to be asked of our candidates at town forums and on TV and radio shows. When I say legalization won't happen without your support and action, it's the truth. It's been going on for 70 years now, folks, but it can change in just a year with your help. So make sure you get involved today. Don't let the federal government continue spreading false 70-year-old propaganda anymore, folks. The truth is in the science, and the science is out there every single day. You can read it up on Normal's website. So if you have questions, get informed. Once you are informed, get active. Thanks for listening again today. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. We're back at 4:20 tomorrow.
76% of Americans no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana. And over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and coworkers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORML. My name is Keith Stropp, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORML, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.
You've been listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's NORMALAUDIOSTASH.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of NORML is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.